Coming up, the role of race in a trial for murder. Tim O'Brien looks at a case to be argued Monday before the Supreme Court. And Kim Lawton talks with Bishop Michael Curry, the first African-American to be installed as presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. Plus, for All Saints Day and All Souls Day, making prayer flags to honor the dead.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. There were some strong religious statements on climate change this week. The Dalai Lama, Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh, and other key Buddhist leaders demanded an end to the use of fossil fuels. The leaders released a statement on Thursday ahead of the United Nations Conference on Climate Change in Paris next month. The statement said their call to action was grounded in the Buddhist teaching of universal interdependence. Roman Catholic bishops from around the world released their own statement. Bishops from five continents pleaded for a major breakthrough in Paris and asked that the climate agreement reached there be truly transformational. Citing Pope Francis's recent letter on the environment, the bishops reaffirmed that the natural environment is both made for everyone and the responsibility of all. Like Francis, the Catholic bishops called special attention to the poor. This week, Francis marked the 50th anniversary of the Vatican document Nostra Aetate. Nostra Aetate revolutionized the Church's relations with other religions, especially Judaism. It's considered one of the most important documents to come out of the Second Vatican Council. The Pope called for greater interfaith collaboration in the face of religious extremism. People of several faiths were part of the audience. Our report from last week on Nostra Aetate is on our website. Amid ongoing violence between Israelis and Palestinians, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has insisted there is no plan to change the status quo at the Jerusalem holy site that Jews call the Temple Mount and Muslims call the Noble Sanctuary. In a new video, Netanyahu also denied any intention to divide the site. Under a decades-old agreement, Jews may visit the compound but not pray there. Some Jewish activists have been pushing for the right to pray. Rumors that Israel intended to change the status quo set off weeks of violence. After meetings last week with Secretary of State John Kerry, Israeli and Palestinian leaders agreed to a plan to install surveillance cameras at the holy site. Kerry said he hopes that will help diffuse tensions. In Europe, Jesuit leaders released a statement expressing deep concern about the migrant crisis. They urged European officials to fix the current broken system of border controls. They also called for a unified approach among countries for those seeking asylum. Meanwhile, the European Union lashed out at member countries for not doing more to help the thousands of migrants fleeing war and persecution. Faith-based groups are among those mobilizing to help victims of this week's devastating earthquake along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. Hundreds of people were killed and thousands of homes were destroyed. The group Islamic Relief is sending teams to assess the needs, and the Catholic group Caritas is also preparing to distribute emergency aid. But workers are having difficulty reaching many remote areas, and many victims say they have not yet received any help. The group Doctors Without Borders said airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen destroyed one of their hospitals this week. Patients and staff were evacuated, but there were no reported deaths. The Saudis denied responsibility. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders continues demanding an independent investigation into the October 3rd U.S. airstrike against its hospital in Afghanistan. The group has raised the confirmed death toll in that incident to 30, with several people still unaccounted for. The U.S. said that the airstrike was a mistake. Doctors Without Borders said it was a violation of international law. China has announced a change to its controversial one-child policy. All Chinese families will soon be allowed to have two children. The one-child policy was adopted in 1980 out of concern about rising population rates. Many religious groups criticized the law's severe penalties, including forced abortions and sterilizations. Chinese leaders have now decided to increase the number of children as a way to address their country's rapidly aging workforce. A liberal Saudi blogger sentenced to 10 years in prison and 1,000 lashes for insulting Muslim clerics has won the European Union's prestigious Sakharov Prize for Human Rights. Raif Badawi is serving a 10-year sentence after being convicted of insulting Islam. Badawi criticized Saudi Arabian clergy. His imprisonment and punishment have generated human rights protests calling for his release. This Monday, the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear arguments about alleged racial discrimination in a trial for murder. Our legal correspondent Tim O'Brien says the question is whether race was an illegal factor when an all-white jury in Georgia convicted and sentenced to death a black defendant.
It was in 1986 in Rome, Georgia, 8:30 at night. 79-year-old Queen White had just returned home from choir practice to confront a burglar who would take her life. Prosecutors said it was this man, Timothy Foster, 18 years old at the time. They say he bashed her skull with a fire log and then strangled her. She had also been sexually molested. Down at the Floyd County Courthouse, and over the vehement objections of defense lawyers, prosecutors excused all African Americans from the jury pool. Foster would be tried, convicted, and sentenced to die by an all-white jury.
The U.S. Supreme Court had ruled only 4 months before this crime was committed that while lawyers have wide latitude in selecting juries and may even excuse some prospective jurors without explaining why, race can never be a factor. Should it appear that race is the motive, the attorney must be able to provide race-neutral reasons.
The reasons given here, some were false. They just simply weren't true. Some were contradictory. In fact, on their list of people that they definitely were going to strike, the five African Americans were the first five listed. And then there was only one other person on the list, and it was a white woman. So the priority was to strike all the blacks from the jury.
Stephen Bright runs the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta and will argue Foster's case before the Supreme Court. Proving jurors were removed because of their race can be difficult, but lawyers at the center say they have come up with some persuasive new evidence.
Well, what we found was the prosecutor's files. And in the prosecutor's files, they had listed, they race-coded and color-coded all the black people in the lists of the jurors. They had identified jurors with things like B1, B2, B3. They had compared the black jurors against each other in their notes that if we have to accept a black, maybe this one would be okay, which suggests that the goal, of course, was to get rid of all the blacks. And so when you add it all together and look at all of the evidence together, it all points pretty much in one direction, which is race.
Lawyers for the state declined to be interviewed and referred us to the brief they filed in the Supreme Court in which they deny any wrongdoing. A 10-year study of 332 criminal cases in Louisiana found that the likelihood of acquittal does go up significantly with the number of blacks on the jury. When there were at least three blacks on the jury, 12% of the defendants were acquitted. The acquittal rate rose to 19% with five or more black jurors. And no one was acquitted in the study when there were two or fewer black jurors. In all three groups, the defendants were overwhelmingly black.
So if the prosecutor is entirely legitimately trying to remove those jurors that he believes are more likely to be opposed to the death penalty, the natural effect of that is going to be that he will use more peremptory challenges against African-American jurors. But that's legitimate. That's how the system works.
Ken Scheidegger is legal director of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, a victims' rights group that supports capital punishment. And Scheidegger says the fact that the prosecutors kept notes on the race of the jurors doesn't prove racial discrimination, but rather may help to refute it.
The fact that you keep track of the race of the jurors as you go through the process is not at all suspicious. In order to defend yourself against charges of discrimination, you have to keep track. That's why every time we apply for a loan or a job or a school admission, we're asked to specify our race, and that's all they were doing in this case.
If all you wanted was to know information about the black jurors, you wouldn't write things like, if we have to accept a black, maybe this one will be okay.
You really don't know what's going through the prosecutor's mind.
Right.
Unless you have a mind reader.
Right.
You want his conviction set aside.
Right.
But what more than that? What do you want the court to say? What rule would you have them announce?
Always in these cases, what the court says about jury selection and what it says about the reasons that prosecutors have to give for striking people of color from juries, that's going to affect every case from now on. And one of the things that I hope at the very least will come out of this case is that the court will require the reasons given be scrutinized much more carefully than they were in this case.
The Foster case goes before the Supreme Court at a time of dwindling executions in the U.S. and growing opposition to capital punishment. On his recent visit to Washington, Pope Francis called for worldwide abolition out of respect for human life.
This conviction has led me from the beginning of my ministry to advocate at different levels the global abolition of the death penalty.
The pontiff's appeal is not likely to have an impact at the Supreme Court level, even though six of the current justices are Catholic, more Catholics than at any time in the country's history.
Here, the issue is not what states should do, but rather what the Constitution and its ban on cruel and unusual punishment forbids them from doing. Significantly, last June, two justices formally urged the court to reconsider whether the United States is even capable of administering capital punishment in a constitutional manner.
The justices, Stephen Breyer, joined by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, both of whom happen to be Jewish, noted that the risk of executing an innocent person remains great, that factors such as race, gender, and geography make the death penalty arbitrary, that the decades-long delays between sentence and execution defeat the goals of deterrence and retribution, and that both death sentences and actual executions are becoming increasingly unusual, down almost 70% in the last 15 years.
I recognize that we are a court, not a legislature, but the matters I have discussed are judicial matters. They concern the infliction of an unfair, cruel, and unusual punishment upon individuals at odds with a specific constraint that the Constitution imposes upon the democratic process.
It is widely believed that two other more liberal justices on the court, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, may share those views, although they have yet to formally declare their position. The country appears to be slowly but inexorably moving away from capital punishment. If so, the U.S. Supreme Court may not be too far behind. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien in Washington.
The Episcopal Church has a new top leader. This weekend, Bishop Michael Curry is being installed as the denomination's presiding bishop. He's the first African American in the position. Curry assumes leadership of a denomination that has struggled in recent years with declining membership and divisions over theological issues, including homosexuality. Kim Lawton talked with Bishop Curry about his challenges and priorities.
For centuries, the Episcopal Church has been considered a bastion of American mainline Protestantism. Its new leader, Bishop Michael Curry, is pushing the church to move beyond its institutional confines.
Jesus of Nazareth really didn't found an institution. He started a movement. I see us re-engaging that movement and living it out as the Episcopal Church, as a part of that Jesus movement.
Let me present to you Bishop Michael Bruce Curry.
Curry was elected the church's 27th presiding bishop at the denomination's general convention this summer. He's the first African-American to hold the position.
This is the church where I was baptized as a baby.
Curry succeeds Bishop Catherine Jefford Shorey, the first woman to lead the denomination. He says he doesn't believe either was elected solely on the basis of race or gender.
Her voice was the voice our church needed at that particular mission moment in its life. That she was a woman was good, but that was an add-on. That wasn't what drove it. It was that she was the right voice. She was the leader we needed. I think that was true with me as well.
Many early Episcopalians were slave owners, and in recent years, the church has apologized for its complicity with slavery, segregation, and racism. Curry says his election is a sign of how far the church has moved.
We are learning to begin to look at people for who they are and what they bring, not simply by the color of their skin or their gender or their sexual orientation or their socioeconomic background, that we're actually beginning to go deeper. That's an important step, and I think that's significant. It really is significant. But there's more work to do.
Delegates to the church's convention identified racial reconciliation and evangelism as two critical priorities for the next several years. Curry says one of his biggest challenges may be winning over Episcopalians who are uncomfortable with the idea of evangelizing others.
We Episcopalians are very gentle. We are ladies and gentlemen, and I'm not talking about an evangelism. That's not us. Evangelism is about helping somebody find their way to God. I think it would be pretty cool if the Episcopal Church was known for that.
Lift up your hearts.
In the last decade, the Episcopal Church has lost about 20% of its membership, which now stands at under 2 million members. Part of that decline was generated by the controversy that has roiled the denomination since the 2003 election of Bishop Gene Robinson, the church's first openly gay bishop. Some theologically conservative congregations have left the denomination, and millions of dollars have been spent on litigation over property. At a news conference after his election, Curry was asked whether he will continue the stance toward the departing churches that was taken under Bishop Jefford Shorey.
As a bishop, I am supportive of our presiding bishop and the policies of our church, and I continue that. I can also tell you that I am committed to the work of reconciliation. I think that is part of our gospel mandate.
Curry says he wants to wait until he has assumed his new office before he specifies how he hopes to address the divisions. He supports the church's position in favor of same-sex marriage, but also says any congregation that disagrees is not forced to comply.
Room for equality for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, but also equality for those whose conscience may differ and may disagree with that. We're going to make room for us all. My slave ancestors used to sing a spiritual that said, there's plenty good room in my Father's kingdom. And there really is.
Curry asserts it is possible to have unity even in the midst of disagreements.
We have things that we disagree about. But you know what? Disagreement isn't anything new in the church. Just read the New Testament. The question is not will there be a disagreement, but will there be a deeper unity? And I think part of our challenge now is to call us to that deeper unity and that mission that the world needs right now.
For the last 15 years, Curry has been bishop of the Diocese of North Carolina, where he was active in social justice causes. He supported the faith-based Moral Monday protests at the Republican-led state legislature that highlighted issues including voting rights, immigration, and poverty.
If you look at the state budget and you look at the weight of the tax reform, it is heavily weighted to the wealthy and, to be sure, to the corporations. And the working poor are the ones who are bearing the brunt of the burden.
The 62-year-old bishop grew up in Buffalo, New York, where his father was an Episcopal minister. Curry says it was there that he acquired a love of football.
I'm a Buffalo Bills fan, which means I am sometimes acquainted with grief.
Stand up for Jesus and go forth and witness to that Jesus in this world. Oh, sing with me now. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.
A graduate of Yale Divinity School, Curry is known across the denomination for his humor and his dynamic preaching style. He admits it often can be a challenge for religious leaders to maintain their own spiritual vitality. He tries to go on an annual retreat. In addition to daily prayers and scripture reading, he says he gets spiritual strength from working out.
I mean, I go to the gym every morning, and it may not look like it, but I actually do go to the gym, which actually is, it's amazing. You can go and work out, and I hate it. You know, I get up at 5 and force myself to go. All I can tell you is I can't tell you how many sermons I have written on a treadmill.
He started taking violin lessons several years ago and says that, too, is a spiritual exercise.
I love it. It's just it's the best therapy in the world. It is like, if you've ever done centering prayer, where you have to focus on one thing, one word, one image, and you just keep coming back to that image, even when you get distracted, keep coming back. It's the meditation, you're centering down. The violin is like that, because if you start thinking about other stuff, the bow gets out of control.
Curry will be leading the Episcopal Church from the denomination's headquarters in New York City. He says he wants to see Episcopalians partner with other faith groups to, in his words, move toward becoming the human family of God.
Because when that happens, then we don't let children go to bed hungry. When that happens, we don't let injustice reign. When that happens, we figure out how to settle our disputes in nonviolent and peaceful ways. When that happens, we figure out how to care for this creation.
Curry says he caught a vision for the church on a recent trip to Selma, Alabama, when he was staying near the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where civil rights protesters were beaten 50 years ago.
I realized that that bridge, filled with so much pain and memory, also was the crucible of hope. Because crossing that bridge was crossing from a painful past into a hopeful future. That's our work. To find ways to be a bridge community that does bring differing people together under the rubric of love.
It's work he believes can help change the world. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
On our calendar, Sunday, November 1st, is All Saints Day, when many Western Christians honor saints and martyrs. Monday the 2nd is All Souls Day, when they remember all who have died. On this day, Catholics specifically pray for the souls of people in purgatory. There are different traditions to commemorate this season, which some Christians call Hallowtide. We visited a program at Washington National Cathedral where people made prayer flags in remembrance of friends and loved ones who've died. Spiritual Director Susie Klein Massey described the spiritual significance of making the flags.
We're going to be making prayer flags using very simple art materials as a way to remember those who have passed. We're praying collectively. We're creating a sacred space in that prayer. We're blessing our implements that we're using. The space is blessed. And then we'll be imagining, maybe having an image in our minds of those people or animals that we want to remember. And then just really allowing the spirit to work through us. That may sound a little woo-woo to some people, but it really is about getting out of your own way. People will do drawings. They'll write words of remembrance. They may write a prayer. They may write parts of a hymn, anything that feels comfortable or right for them. Calling this remembering the saints of our lives. We may not be referring to saints that are traditionally known as saints, but rather people in our lives who have been very meaningful to us and seem to exemplify very high ideals of humanity. We're hoping there'll be lots of flags that we can hang in the Resurrection Chapel here. I think it's going to be an interesting combination of play and grief and joy and mourning We want to have a sense of divinity that runs through the experience. And the way we do that is we will say a prayer. And the word for divinity could be lots of different things for lots of different people. It could be God, but it could be spirit. It could be love. It could be nature.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from Mexico, where All Souls Day is also known as the Day of the Dead. Many celebrations there mix Catholic rituals and indigenous practices to remember those who've died.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.